of those health-wasting diseases which are incident to other countries, according to a very early New England colonist, who apparently ignored the recently introduced European diseases that were then laying waste to the Native Americans. He reported that the Indians lived to 70, 80, some 100 years, before the world's universal summoner cites them to the craving grave. In Maryland, another early settler marveled that many Indians were great-grandfathers, while in England, few people survived to become grandparents. The first Europeans to meet Australian Aborigines noted a range of ages that implied a goodly number lived to be 70. For that matter, Psalm 90 in the Bible implies that thousands of years ago, most people in the Middle East lived to be 70. The years of our lives are 70, and if by reason of strength they be 80, yet is their labor sorrow. Besides fostering ignorance of past societies, belief in progress makes students oblivious to merit in present-day societies other than our own. To conclude that other cultures have achieved little about which we need to know is a natural side effect of believing our society the most progressive. Anthropology professors despair of the severe ethnocentrism shown by many first-year college students. William A. Haviland, author of a popular anthropology textbook, says that in his experience, the possibility that some of the things that we aspire to today, equal treatment of men and women, to cite but one example, have in fact been achieved by some other peoples, simply has never occurred to the average beginning undergraduate. Few high schools offer anthropology courses, and fewer than one American in 10 ever takes a college anthropology course. So we can hardly count on anthropology to reduce ethnocentrism. High school history and social study courses could help open students to ideas from other cultures. That does not happen, however, because the idea of progress saturates these courses from Columbus to their final words. Therefore, they can only promote, not diminish, ethnocentrism. Yet ethnocentric faith in progress in Western culture has had disastrous consequences. People who believed in their society as the vanguard of the future, the most progressive on earth, have been all too likely to indulge in such excessive cruelties as the Pequot Massacre, Stalin's purges, the Holocaust, or the Great Leap Forward. Rather than assuming that our ways must be best, textbook authors would do well to challenge students to think about practices from the American way of birth to the American way of death. Some elements of modern medicine, for instance, are inarguably more effective and based on far better theory than previous medicines. On the other hand, our scientific anti-gravity way of birth, which dominated delivery rooms in the United States from about 1930 to 1970, shows the influence of the idea of progress at its most laughable. The analogy for childbirth was an operation. The doctor anesthetized the mother and removed the anesthetized infant like a gallbladder. Even as late as 1992, only half of all women who gave birth in U.S. hospitals breastfed their babies, even though we now know, as primitive societies never forgot, that human milk, not bovine milk or formula, is designed for human babies. If history textbooks relinquished their blind devotion to the archetype of progress, they could invite readers to assess technologies as to which have truly been progressive. Defining progress would itself become problematic. Alternative forms of social organization, made possible or perhaps even necessary by technological and economic developments, could also be considered. Today's children may see the decline of the nation-state, for instance, because the problem of the planetary commons may force planetary decision-making, or because growing tribalism may fragment many nations from within. The closing chapters of history textbooks might become inquiry exercises, directing students toward facts and readings on both sides of such issues. Surely such an approach would prepare students for their 6 decades of life after high school better than today's mindlessly upbeat textbook endings. Thoughtfulness about such matters as the quality of life is often touted as a goal of education in the humanities, but history textbooks sweep such topics under the brightly colored rug of progress. Textbooks manifest no real worries even about the environmental downside of our economic and scientific institutions. Instead, they stress the fortunate adequacy of our government's reaction. As time went on, scientists discovered more about the effects of pollutants on the environment, and people became more concerned with environmental health, says the American tradition. In response, Congress passed the National Environmental Policy Act of 1969. Textbook authors seem much happier telling of the governmental response, mainly the creation of the Environmental Protection Agency, than discussing any continuing environmental problems. Life and Liberty goes the furthest. It prophesies, during the next 20 years, the environment will become a major political issue, and goes on to discuss water shortages, acid rain, and tropical deforestation. But even Life and Liberty ends its discussion. Let us be optimistic. Our difficulties of energy and resource shortages will be solved within the next half century. The authors then speculate happily about such wonders as shorter work weeks, robot workers, lunar colonies, and synthetic foods. The American people have reason to move into the future with confidence. Triumph of the American Nation assures students in its final paragraph. For the same scientific genius and engineering talents that unknowingly created many of the as-yet unsolved problems remain available to solve them. Students find these words about as inspirational as the photograph that accompanies them. John S. Harrington in a business suit. Harrington, you remember, surely you remember, was Secretary of Energy in the Reagan administration. Many students no longer believe that Harrington, or all our scientific genius and engineering talents, will save us. According to a 1993 survey, children are much more concerned about the environment than are their parents. In the late 1980s, about one high school senior in three thought that a nuclear or biological annihilation will probably be the fate of all mankind within their lifetimes. I have talked with my friends about this, a student of mine wrote in her class journal. We all agree that we feel as if we are not going to finish our adult lives. The students had all taken American history courses, but the textbook's regimen of good cheer doesn't seem to have rubbed off on them. Students know when they're being conned. They sense that underneath the mindless optimism is a defensiveness that rings hollow. Or maybe they simply never reached the cheerful endings of their textbooks. Probably the principal effect of the textbook whitewash of environmental issues in favor of the idea of progress is to persuade high school students that American history courses aren't appropriate places to bring up the future course of American history. What is perhaps the key issue of the day will have to be discussed in other classes, maybe science or health, even though it's foremost a social rather than biological or health issue. Meanwhile, back in the history class, more bland, data-free assurances that things are getting better. E.J. Michon has suggested that feeding students rosy tales of automatic progress helps keep them passive, for it presents the future as a process over which they have no control. I don't believe this is why textbooks end as they do, however. Their upbeat endings may best be understood as ploys by publishers who hope that nationalist optimism will get their books adopted. Such endings really amount to concessions of defeat, however, by implying that no real questions about our future need be asked, and no real thinking about trends in our history need be engaged in. Textbook authors concede implicitly that our history has no serious bearing on our future. We can hardly fault students for concluding that the study of history is irrelevant. Chapter 11. Why is history taught like this? I do not know if there is any other field of knowledge which suffers so badly as history from the sheer blind repetitions that occur year after year and from book to book. Herbert Butterfield. When you're publishing a book, if there's something that's controversial, it's better to take it out. Holt, Reinhardt, and Winston, representative. There is no other country in the world where there is such a large gap between the sophisticated understanding of some professional historians and the basic education given by teachers. Mark Farrow. 10 chapters have shown that textbooks supply irrelevant and even erroneous details, while omitting pivotal questions and facts in their treatments of issues ranging from Columbus's second voyage to the possibility of impending ecocide. We have also seen that history textbooks offer students no practice in applying their understanding of the past to present concerns, hence no basis for thinking rationally about anything in the future. Reality gets lost as authors stray further and further from the primary sources, and even the secondary literature. Textbooks rarely present the various sides of historical controversies, and almost never reveal to students the evidence on which each side bases its position. The textbooks are unscholarly in other ways. Of the 12 I studied, only the 2 inquiry textbooks contain any footnotes. 6 of the textbooks even deny students a bibliography. Despite criticisms by scholars from Francis Fitzgerald to Diane Ravitch and Harriet Tyson Bernstein, new editions of old texts come out year after year, largely unchanged. Year after year, clones appear with new authors, but nearly identical covers, titles, and contents. What explains such appalling uniformity? The textbooks must be satisfying somebody. Publishers produce textbooks with several audiences in mind. One is their intended readers, students' characteristics, as publishers perceive them, particularly affect reading level and page layout. Historians and professors of education are another audience, perhaps 2 audiences. Teachers comprise another. Conceptions of the general public also enter publishers' thinking, since public opinion influences adoption committees, and since parents represent a potential interest group that publishers seek not to arouse. Some of these groups have not been shy about what they want textbooks to do. In 1925, the American Legion declaimed that the ideal textbook must inspire the children with patriotism, must be careful to tell the truth optimistically, must dwell on failure only for its value as a moral lesson, must speak chiefly of success, must give each state and section full space and value for the achievements of each. Shirley Engel and Anna Ochoa are longtime luminaries of social studies education, who in 1986 voiced their recommendations for textbooks. From their vantage point, the ideal textbook should confront students with important questions and problems for which answers are not readily available, be highly selective, be organized around an important problem in society that is to be studied in depth, utilize data from a variety of sources such as history, the social sciences, literature, journalism, and from students' first-hand experiences. Today's textbooks hew closely to the American Legion line and disregard the recommendations of Engel and Ochoa. Why? Is the secondary literature in history to blame? We can hardly expect textbook authors to return to primary sources and dig out facts that are truly obscure. A few decades back, the secondary literature in history was quite biased. Until World War II, history, much more than the other social sciences, was overtly anti-Semitic and anti-black. According to Peter Novick, whose book, That Noble Dream, is probably the best account of the history profession in this century, looking at every white college and university in America, exactly 1 black was ever employed to teach history before 1945. Most historians were males from privileged white families. They wrote with blinders on. Arthur Schlesinger Jr. found himself able to write an entire book on the presidency of Andrew Jackson without ever mentioning perhaps the foremost issue Jackson dealt with as president, the removal of Indians from the Southeast. What's more, Schlesinger's book won the Pulitzer Prize. These days, however, The secondary literature in American history is much more comprehensive. About the plagues, for example, Herbert U. Williams wrote, "The epidemic of the Indians of New England, 1616 to 1620, way back in 1909. And Esther W. Stern and Alan E. Stern wrote, "The effect of smallpox on the destiny of the Amerindian in 1945. P.M. Ashburn's classic, The Ranks of Death, A Medical History of the Conquest of America, came out in 1947. In 1951, John Duffy wrote, "Smallpox and the Indians in the American Colonies." For that matter, the most famous of all primary sources on the Pilgrims, William Bradford's Of Plymouth Plantation, clearly discloses the plagues. So we can't excuse history textbooks on the grounds that the historical literature is inadequate. The facts about Helen Keller are hardly obscure either. No dusty newspaper archives need be searched. The truth about Woodrow Wilson's interventions and his racism has also been available in scholarly works for decades, although most biographies of the man ignore it. Indeed, every chapter of this book has been based on commonly available research. Competent historians will find nothing new here. The information is all there, in the secondary literature, but hasn't made its way into our textbooks, media, or teacher training programs, and therefore hasn't reached our schools. As a consequence, according to comparative historian Mark Farreau, the United States is wound up with the largest gap of any country in the world between what historians know and what the rest of us are taught. Could these omissions be a question of professional judgment? Authors can't include every event. The past is immense. No book claims to be complete. Decisions must be made. What is important? What is appropriate for a given age level? Perhaps teachers should devote no time at all to Helen Keller, no matter how heroic she was. But when we look at what textbooks do include, when we contemplate the minute details, some of them false, that they foist upon us about Columbus, for example, we have to think again. Constraints of time and space can't be causing textbooks to leave out any discussion of what Columbus did with the Americas or how Europe came to dominate the world, since these issues are among the most vital in all the broad sweep of the past. Perhaps an upper-class conspiracy is to blame. Perhaps we are all dupes, manipulated by elite white male capitalists who orchestrate how history is written as part of their scheme to perpetuate their own power and privilege at the expense of the rest of us. Certainly high school history textbooks are so similar that they look like they might all have been produced by the same executive committee of the bourgeoisie. In 1984, George Orwell was clear about who determines the way history is written. Who controls the present controls the past. The symbolic representation of a society's past is particularly important in stratified societies. The United States is stratified, of course, by social class, by race, and by gender. Some sociologists think that social inequality motivates people, prompting harder work and more innovative performance. Inequality is also intrinsically unfair, however, because those with more money, status, and influence use their advantage to get still more for themselves and their children. In a society marked by inequality, people who have endured less than equal opportunities may become restive. Members of favored groups may become ashamed of the unfairness, unable to defend it to the oppressed or even to themselves. To maintain a stratified system, it's terribly important to control how people think about that system. Marx advanced this analysis under the rubric false consciousness. How people think about the past is an important part of their consciousness. If members of the elite come to think that their privilege was historically justified and earned, it will be hard to persuade them to yield opportunity to others. If members of deprived groups come to think that their deprivation is their own fault, then there will be no need to use force or violence to keep them in their places. Textbooks offer an obvious means of realizing hegemony in education, according to William L. Griffin and John Marciano, who analyzed textbook treatment of the Vietnam War. By hegemony, we refer specifically to the influence that dominant classes or groups exercise by virtue of their control of ideological institutions, such as schools, that shape perception on such vital issues as the Vietnam War. Within history texts, for example, the omission of crucial facts and viewpoints limits profoundly the ways in which students come to view history events. Further, through their one-dimensionality, textbooks shield students from intellectual encounters with their world that would sharpen their critical abilities. Here, in polite academic language, Griffin and Marciano tell us that controlling elements of our society keep crucial facts from us to keep us ignorant and stupid. Most scholars of education share this perspective, often referred to as critical theory. Jonathan Kozel is of this school when he writes, "School is in business to produce reliable people." Paulo Freire of Brazil puts it this way, "It would be extremely naive to expect the dominant classes to develop a type of education that would enable subordinate classes to perceive social injustices critically." Henri Giroux, Freire's leading disciple in the United States, maintains, "The dominant culture actively functions to suppress the development of critical historical consciousness among the populace." David Tayek and Elizabeth Hansot tell us when this all started. Between 1890 and 1920, businessmen came to have by far a greater impact on public education than any other occupational group or stratum. Some writers on education even conclude that upper-class control makes real improvement impossible. In a critique of educational reform initiatives, Henry M. Levin stated, "The educational system will always be applied toward serving the role of cultural transmission and preserving the status quo. The public schools we have today are what the powerful and the considerable have made of them," wrote Walter Karp. "They will not be redeemed by trifling reforms." These writers on education take their cue from an even weightier school of thought in social science, the power elite theorists. This school has shown that an upper class does exist in America, whose members can be found at elegant private clubs, gatherings of the Trilateral Commission, and board meetings of the directors of the multinational corporations. Rich capitalists control all three major TV networks, most newspapers, and all the textbook publishing companies, and thus possess immense power to frame the way we talk and think about current events. Nevertheless, I wonder whether it is appropriate to lay this particular bundle on the doorstep of the upper class. To blame the power elite for what is taught in a rural Vermont school or an inner-city classroom somehow seems too easy. If the elite is so dominant, why hasn't it also censored the books and articles that expose its influence in education? Paradoxically, critical theory cannot explain its own popularity. Any upper class worth its salt, so dominant and so monolithic that it determines how American history is taught in almost every American classroom, must also have the power to marginalize those social scientists who expose it. But the upper class has hardly kept critical theory out of education. On the contrary, critical theorists dominate scholarship in the field. Their books get prominently published and well reviewed. Education professors assign them to thousands of students every year. The upper class controls publishing, to be sure, but its control doesn't extend to content, at least not if the books in question make money. Prentice Hall, which published Who Rules America Now? By William Domhoff, is owned by Simon & Schuster, which in turn is owned by Paramount, which used to be part of the conglomerate Gulf & Western, but is about to become part of something else. Savage Inequalities by Jonathan Kozel was published by Crown, part of Random House, which is in turn part of the Newhouse corporate empire. One of the glories of capitalism is that somewhere there are publishers who will publish almost any book so long as they stand to make a profit from it. If the upper class forces the omission of crucial facts and viewpoints, then why has it failed to censor the entire marvelous secondary literature in American history, which occasionally even breaks into primetime public television in series like Eyes on the Prize, an account of the civil rights movement? The upper class seems to be falling down on the job. The elite has also failed to censor American history museums. After textbooks, museums are probably our society's most important purveyors of American history to the public. Unlike textbooks, however, many history museums have undergone considerable changes in the last two decades. The National Museum of American History, part of the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C., offers an illustration. Its newer exhibits, such as Field to Factory, about the northward migration of African Americans, A More Perfect Union, portraying Japanese-American concentration camps during World War II, and American Encounters, about the clash and mix of Indian, Latino, and Anglo cultures in New Mexico, criticize aspects of our recent national past. In the same period, the Museum of the Confederacy in Richmond, Virginia, mounted its first ever exhibit on slavery, which included chains, torture devices, and a catalog that didn't minimize the inhumanity of the institution. If museums reflect the interests of the power structure, are we to infer that the elite mellowed in the 1980s and early 1990s? These were the Reagan-Bush years, when the administration criticized the arts and humanities endowments from a conservative and nationalist stance. We must conclude, mixing a metaphor, that the power elite didn't have its thumb on every pie. To be sure, museum boards include members of the upper class. Robert Heilbronner has pointed out that no matter what is done in America, members of the upper class usually have a hand in it. However, their participation doesn't mean that they directed the action, nor that it was in their class's interest. In the early 1960s, for instance, when elite colleges and universities recruited almost solely in private and suburban public high schools and relied on standardized tests to screen applicants, their student bodies were overwhelmingly white. The power elite theorists could claim that the elite reserved these positions of privilege for their own offspring as part of the structure of unequal opportunity. In the late 1960s, when the same universities competed to recruit and admit African American students, the power elite theorists could claim that the elite was co-opting the cream of ghetto society in order to stifle protest and maintain the structure of unequal opportunity. Thus, critical or power elite theories seem to explain everything, but may explain nothing. Interestingly, the upper class may not even control what is taught in its own history classrooms. Preppies, who attend the University of Vermont, are more likely than public school graduates to have encountered high school history teachers who challenged them and diverged from the rote use of textbooks. Such teachers' success in teaching subversively in the belly of the upper class should hearten us to believe that it can be done anywhere. On the other hand, if textbooks are devised by the upper class to manipulate youngsters to support the status quo, they hardly seem to be succeeding. Instead of revering Columbus, students wind up detesting history. Evidence suggests that history textbooks and courses make little impact in increasing trust in the United States or in inducing good citizenship, however these are measured. Voting is the one form of citizenship that the textbooks push, yet voting in America is way down, especially among recent high school graduates. The fact that social studies and history courses give citizenship such a sanctimonious tinge may help explain why fewer than 17% of eligible voters aged 18 to 24 voted in 1986. In sum, power elite theories may credit the upper class with more power, unity, and conscious self-interest than it has. Indeed, regarding their alleged influence on American history textbooks, they may be scapegoats. Blaming the power elite is comforting. Power elite theory offers tidy explanations. Educational institutions can't reform because the upper class prevents it, or the reform isn't in that class's interest. Accordingly, power elite theory may create a world more satisfying and more coherent and evil than the real world with which we are all complicit. Power elite theories thus absolve the rest of us from seeing that all of us participate in the process of cultural distortion. This line of thought not only excuses us from responsibility for the sorry state of American history as currently taught, It also frees us from the responsibility for changing it. What's the use? Any action we might take would be inconsequential by definition. Upper-class control may not be necessary to explain textbook misrepresentation, however. Special pressures in the world of textbook publishing may account to some extent for the uniformity and dullness of American history textbooks. Almost half the states have textbook adoption boards. Some of these boards function explicitly as censors, making sure that books not only meet criteria for length, coverage, and reading level, but also that they avoid topics and treatments that might offend some parents. States without such boards aren't necessarily freer of censorship. For there, screening usually takes place on the local level, where concern about giving offense can be even more immediate. Moreover, states without textbook boards constitute smaller markets, since publishers must win approval at the individual district or school level. Therefore, states without boards have less influence on publishers, who orient their best efforts towards the large states with adoption boards. California, and Texas in particular, directly affect publishers and textbooks because they are large markets with statewide adoption and active lobbying groups. Schools and districts in non-adoption states must choose among books designated for the larger markets. Textbook adoption processes are complex. Some states, such as Tennessee, accept almost every book that meets certain basic criteria for binding, reading level, and subject matter. Tennessee schools then select from among perhaps 24 books, usually making district-wide decisions. At the other extreme, Alabama adopts just one book per subject. State textbook boards are usually small committees whose members have been appointed by the governor or the state commissioner of education. They are volunteers who may be teachers, lawyers, parents, or other concerned citizens. The daily work of the textbook board is typically performed by a small staff that begins by circulating specifications, which tell publishers the grade level, physical requirements, size, binding, and the like, and guidelines as to the content for all subjects in which they next plan to adopt textbooks. Publishers respond by sending books and ancillary materials. Meanwhile, the board, with input from the person or persons who appointed them, and sometimes with staff input as well, sets up rating committees in each subject area. For instance, high school American history. The staff holds orientation meetings for these rating committees, explains the forms used for rating the textbooks, and then sends the books to the raters. Usually one formal meeting is set up for the publisher's representatives to address the rating committees. Large states may hold several meetings in different parts of the state. At these meetings, the representatives emphasize the ways in which their books excel. For the most part, representatives push form, not content. They tout special features of layout, artwork, skills building, and ancillary materials such as videos and exams. Rating committees face a Herculean task. Remember that the 12 books I examined average 888 pages. I have spent much of the last 10 years struggling to comprehend and evaluate these books. In a single summer, raters cannot even read all the books, let alone compare them meaningfully. Raters also wrestle with an average of 73 different rating criteria, which they apply to each book they rate, an Augean stable. Therefore, publishers' representatives can make a difference. Since raters have time only to flip through most books, they look for easy readability, newness, a stunning color cover, appealing design, color illustrations, ancillary film strips, and ready-made teaching aids and test questions, seizing on these attitudes as surrogates for quality. Unfortunately, marketing textbooks is like marketing fishing lures. The point is to catch fishermen, not fish. Thus many adopted textbooks are flashy to catch the eye of adoption committees, but dull when read by students. What content do adopters want to see? First off, they look for their own state. In Vermont, woe to the textbook that omits Chester A. Arthur, famed 21st President of these United States. While he never made it very far into the hearts of his countrymen, Arthur had best get into the pages of its textbooks, because he is one of only two presidents Vermont produced. The Alamo lies deep in the heart of white Texans. Woe to any textbook that might point out that love of slavery motivated Anglos to fight there for freedom. California's legislature recently debated a bill to require textbooks to include the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II. Usually, adopters find the details they seek. Most textbook editors start their careers in publishing as sales representatives. They are not historians, but they know their market. They include whatever is likely to be of concern. Everything gets mentioned. Lynn Cheney, former director of the National Endowment for the Humanities, decried the result. Textbooks come to seem like glossaries of historical events, compendiums of topics. In some states, the next step is hearings, in which the public is invited to comment on books approved by the rating committees. In Texas and California, at least, these are occasions at which organized groups attack or promote one or more of the selections, often contending that a book fails to meet a requirement found in the regulations or specifications. Although publishers lament the procedure, critics, particularly in Texas, have unearthed and forced publishers to correct hundreds of errors, from misspellings to the claim that President Truman easily settled the Korean War by dropping the atomic bomb. Since adoption committees do try to please constituents, those who complain at hearings often make a difference. Adoption states used to pressure publishers overtly to espouse certain points of view. For years, any textbook sold in Dixie had to call the Civil War the war between the states. Earlier editions of The American Pageant used the even more pro-Confederate term, the War for Southern Independence, and did exceptionally well in Southern states. Only after the Civil Rights Movement did pageant revert to the Civil War. Alabama law used to require that schools avoid textbooks containing anything partisan, prejudicial, or inimical to the interests of the white people of the state, or that would cast a reflection on their past history. Texas still requires that textbooks shall not contain material which serves to undermine authority. Such standards are astounding in their breadth and might force drastic cuts in almost every chapter of every textbook, except that authors have already omitted most unpleasantries and controversies. Many states have rewritten their textbook specifications to strike such blatant content requirements. Since at least 1970, Mississippi's regulations, for example, have consisted of a series of clichés with which no reasonable textbook author or critic could disagree. Publishers might be forgiven if they believe that the spirit of the old regulations still survives, however, for the initial rejection of Mississippi, Conflict and Change proves that it does. I was senior author of the book, a revisionist state history text, finally published by Pantheon Books in 1974. I say finally because Pantheon brought it out only after 11 other publishers refused. The problem wasn't with the quality of the manuscript, which won the Lillian Smith Award. The problem was that trade publishers said they could not publish a textbook, while textbook publishers said they could not publish a book so unlikely to be adopted. Some publishers even feared that Mississippi might retaliate against their textbooks and other subjects. Textbook publishers proved partly right. The textbook board refused to allow our book. It contained too much black history, featured a photograph of a lynching, and gave too much attention to the recent past, according to the white majority on the rating committee. My co-authors and I, joined by three school districts that wanted to adopt the book, sued the state in a First Amendment challenge. Lowen et al. V. Turnipseed et al. And in 1980, got the book on the state's approved list. Another force for uniform conservative textbooks comes from publishing houses themselves. There's a great deal of copying, Carolyn Jackson, who has probably edited more American history textbooks than any other single individual, told me. Every house covets the success of Triumph of the American Nation, which holds a quarter to a third of the American market, Although adequate scholarship exists in the secondary literature to support such ventures intellectually, not a single left-wing or right-wing American history textbook has ever been published. Neither has a major textbook emphasized African-American, Latino, labor, or feminist history as the entry point to general American history. Such books might sell dozens of thousands of copies a year and make thousands of dollars in profit. At the least, they would command niches in the marketplace all their own. Publishers might do fine without Texas. Nonetheless, no publishing house can see such possibilities. All are blinded by the golden prospect of putting out the next Triumph and making millions of dollars. One editor characterized a prospective book, perhaps unfairly, as too focused on the mistreatment of blacks in American history. "We couldn't have that as our only American history," he continued, "so we broke the contract." The manuscript was never published. "We didn't want a book with an axe to grind," the editor concluded. Of course, one person's point of view is another's axe to grind, so textbooks end up without axes or points of view. Thus, textbook uniformity cannot be attributed exclusively to overt state censors. Even in the formerly communist countries of Eastern Europe, censorship was largely affected by authors, editors, and publishers, not by state censors, and was ultimately a matter of sensitivity to the ideological atmosphere. It's not too different here. Textbook publishers rarely do anything that they imagine might risk state disapproval. Therefore, they never stray far from the traditional textbooks in form, tone, and content. Indeed, when Scott Forsman merely replaced Macbeth with Hamlet in their literature reader, educators and editors considered the change so radical that Hillel Black devoted 3 pages to the event in his book on textbook publishing, The American Schoolbook. In American history, even more than in literature, publishers strive for a balanced approach to offend no one. Publishers would undoubtedly think twice before including a hard-hitting account of Columbus, for example. In Chapter 2, I used genocide to refer to the destruction of the Arawaks in the Caribbean. When scholars use the same term in applying for a grant for a television series on Columbus from the National Endowment for the Humanities, the endowment rejected them. Lynn Cheney said that the word was a problem. The entire project, 1492, Clash of Visions, was too pro-Indian for the endowment. It's okay to talk about the barbarism of the Indians, but not about the barbarism of the Europeans, according to the series producer. For publishers to avoid giving offense is getting increasingly difficult, however. A dizzying array of critics, creationists, the radical right, civil liberties groups, racial minorities, feminists, and even professional historians have entered the fray. No longer do textbooks get denounced only as integrationist or liberal. Now they are also attacked as colonialist, Eurocentric, or East Coast-centric. Publishers must feel a bit flustered as they delete a passage modestly critical of American policy to please right-wing critics in one state, only to find they have offended left-wing critics in another. Including a paragraph of Henry Cisneros may please Hispanics, but risk denunciation by New Englanders demanding a photograph of John Adams. Although publishers want to think of themselves as moral beings, they also want to make money. "We want to do well while doing good," the president of Random House, the parent company of Pantheon, said to me as he inquired into the commercial prospects of our Mississippi textbook. Thoughts of the bottom line narrow the range of thought publishers tolerate in textbooks. Publishers risk over $500,000 in production costs with every new textbook. Understandably, this scares them. What about the authors? Since every bad paragraph had to have an author, surely authors lie at the heart of the process. It's not always clear who the real authors are, however. According to Hillel Black, the names on the cover of a textbook are rarely those of the people who really wrote it. Lewis Todd and Merle Curti may have written the first draft of Rise of the American Nation back in 1949, but by the time the 10th edition came out in 1991, now titled triumph of the American nation, Curti was 95 and Todd was dead. The people listed as authors on some other textbooks have even less to do with them. Some teachers and historians merely rent their names to publishers, supplying occasional advice in return for a fraction of the usual royalties, while minions in the bowels of the publishing houses do the work of organizing and writing the textbooks. An executive at Prentice Hall told me that James Davidson and Mark Little had written every word of The United States, A History of the Republic, except the skills sections and maybe not the photo captions. She also told me that Daniel Boorstin controls every word that goes into his book, which is not quite the same thing, but does imply substantial author involvement. Prentice Hall relies on Davidson and Little to keep A History of the Republic current in historical content, according to the publisher, but Mark Little claimed more modestly that he and his co-author play only a kind of authentication role regarding new editions. The publisher initiates the new material, and it is too late to make any major changes once it reaches us. The bulk of the publisher's changes have been aimed toward keeping the book up to date, in pedagogical style, and changing the last chapter to bring the book closer to the present. Publishers tend to innovate more than authors, so although new editions may have new looks, and even new bibliographies, they rarely have much new historical content. Gradually, as books move from first to fifth or eighth editions, the listed authors have less and less to do with them. In interviews with me, publishing executives blamed adoption boards, school administrators, or parents, whom they feel they have to please for the distortions and lies of omission that mar U.S. history textbooks. Parents, whether black militants or Texas conservatives, blame publishers. Teachers blame administrators who make them use distasteful books or the publishers who produce them. But authors blame no one. They claim credit for their books. Several authors told me that they suffered no editorial interference. Indeed, authors of three different textbooks told me that their editors never offered a single content suggestion. "That book doesn't have 50 words in it that were changed by the editor," exclaimed one author. "They were so respectful of my judgment, they were obsequious," said another. "I kept waiting for them to say no, but they never did." If authors claim to have written the textbooks as they wanted, then maybe they are to blame for their books. Sometimes they don't know any better. I asked John Garrity, author of American History, why he omitted the plague in New England that devastated American societies before the Pilgrims came. "I didn't know about it," was his straightforward reply. Sometimes authors do know better. As previously mentioned in After the Fact, a book aimed at college history majors, James Davidson and Mark Little do a splendid job telling of the Indian plagues, demonstrating that they understood their geopolitical significance, their devastating impact on Indian culture and religion, and their effect on estimates of the pre-contact Indian population. In After the Fact, looking down from the Olympian heights of academe, Davidson and Little even write, "Textbooks have finally begun to take note of these large-scale epidemics." Meanwhile, their own high school history textbook leaves them out. How are we to understand this kind of behavior? Authors know that even if their textbook is good, it won't really count toward tenure and promotion at most universities, where the message is, "Real scholars don't write textbooks." If the textbook is bad, the authors won't get chastised by the profession because professional historians don't read or review high school textbooks. Thus, the authors' academic reputations aren't really on the line. Adoption boards loom in the textbook author's mind to a degree, especially when publishers bring them up. Authors rarely have a personal knowledge of the adoption process. I am an unfortunate exception. Editors may invoke students' parents as well as adoption boards in cautioning authors not to give offense. "I wanted a text that could be used in every state," one author told me. She relied on her publisher for guidance about what would and would not accomplish this aim. Mark Little characterized his own textbook as a McDonald's version of history. If it has any flavor, people won't buy it. He based this conclusion on his publisher's survey of what the market wanted. On the other hand, publishers know that students, parents, teachers want to see themselves represented in the text, as one editor said to me, and occasionally influence authors to make their books less traditional. Michael Common tells of a publisher who tried to persuade the two authors of an American history textbook to give more space to Native Americans. Thomas Bailey's publisher pressed him to include more women and African Americans in The American Pageant. Regardless of the direction of the input, publishers are in charge. They didn't want famous people because we'd be more tractable, Mark Little told me, explaining why a major publisher had sought out him and James Davidson, relative unknowns. Two widely published authors told me that publishers tore up textbook contracts with them because they didn't like the political slant of their manuscripts. We have arguments, one editor told me bluntly. We usually win. Very different conditions apply to secondary works in history, where the intended readership typically includes professional historians. Authors of book-length secondary works know that publishers and journal editors hire professional historians to evaluate manuscripts, so they write for other historians from the beginning. Writers also know that other historians will review their monographs after publication, and their reputation will be made or broken by those reviews in the historical journals. With such different readerships, it's natural for secondary works and textbooks to be very different from each other. Textbook authors need not concern themselves unduly with what actually happened in history, since publishers use patriotism rather than scholarship to sell their books. This emphasis should hardly be surprising. The requirement to take American history originated as part of a nationalist flag-waving campaign early in this century. Publishers start the pitch on their outside covers, where nationalist titles such as The Challenge of Freedom and Land of Promise are paired with traditional patriotic icons, Eagles, Independence Hall, the Stars and Stripes, and the Statue of Liberty. Publishers market the books as tools for helping students to discover our common beliefs and appreciate our heritage. No publisher tries to sell a textbook with the claim that it's more accurate than its competitors. Textbook authors also bear their student readers in mind, to a degree. From my own experience, I know that imagining what one's readers need is an important part of the process of writing a history textbook. Some textbook authors are high school teachers, but most are college professors who know only a few high school or junior high school students personally. Interviews with textbook authors reveal that their imagining of what students need is a strange process. Something about the enterprise of writing a high school American history textbook converts historians into patriots. One author told me that she was the single parent of an 11-year-old girl when she started to work on her textbook. She wanted to write a book that Samantha would be proud of. I empathized with this desire and told her of my own single parenting of a daughter about the same age. Further conversation made clear, however, that this author didn't simply mean a book her daughter would respect and enjoy. Rather, she wanted a book that would make her daughter feel good about America, a very different thing. Other textbook authors have shared similar comments with me. They want to produce good citizens, by which they mean people who take pride in their country. Somehow authors feel they must strap on the burden of transmitting and defending Western civilization. Sometimes there is almost a touch of depression in their comments, sort of a après moi le déluge. Authors can feel that they get only one shot at these children. If they don't reach them now, America's future might be jeopardized. In turn, this leads to a feeling of self-importance, that one is on the front line of our society, helping the United States continue to grow strong. Not only textbook authors feel this way, historians and history teachers commonly cite their role in building good citizens to justify what they do. In A Proud Word for History, Alan Nevins waxes euphoric over school texts that told of Plymouth Rock, Valley Forge and the Alamo. He lauds history's role in making a nation strong, developing in the young such traits as character, morals, ethics, and good citizenship, according to Richard Gross, former president of the National Council for the Social Studies, are the reasons for studying history and the social sciences. When we were writing our Mississippi history, my co-authors and I felt the same way, that we might improve our state and its citizens by imparting knowledge and changing attitudes in its next generation. When the authors of American history textbooks have their chance to address the next generation at large, however, even those who are in their monographs and private conversations are critical of some aspects of our society. They seem to want only to maintain America rather than change it. One textbook author, Carol Birkin, began her interview with me by saying, "As a historian, I am a feminist socialist." My jaw dropped, because her textbook displays no hint of feminism or socialism. Surely a feminist author would write a textbook that would help readers understand why no woman has ever been president or even vice president of the United States. Surely a socialist author would write a textbook that would enable readers to understand why children of working-class families don't become president or vice president, the mythical Abraham Lincoln to the contrary. If textbooks are overstuffed, overlong, often wrong, mindless, boring, and all alike, why do teachers use them? In one sense, teachers are responsible for the miseducation in our history classrooms. After all, the distortions and omissions exposed in the first 10 chapters of this book are lies our teachers tell us. If enough teachers complained about American history textbooks, wouldn't publishers change them? Teachers also play a substantial role in adopting the textbooks. In most states, textbook rating committees are made up mainly of teachers, from whom publishers have faced no groundswell of opposition. On the contrary, many teachers like the textbooks as they are. According to researchers K.K. Wong and T. Lovelace, most teachers believe that history textbooks are good and getting better. Could it be that they just don't know the truth? Many history teachers don't know much history. A national survey of 257 teachers in 1990 revealed that 13% had never taken a college history course, and only 40% held a B.A. or M.A. in history, or had a major with some history in it. Furthermore, a study of Indiana teachers revealed that fewer than 1 in 5 stay current by reading books or articles in American history. A group of high school history teachers at a recent conference on Christopher Columbus and the age of exploitation gasped out loud to learn that people before Columbus knew the world to be round. These teachers were mortified to realize that for years they had been disseminating false information. Of course, teachers cannot teach that which they do not know. Most teachers don't like controversy. A study some years ago found that 92% of teachers didn't initiate discussion of controversial issues. 89% didn't discuss controversial issues when students brought them up. And 79% didn't believe they should. Among the topics that teachers felt children were interested in discussing, but that most teachers believed should not be discussed in the classroom, were the Vietnam War, politics, race relations, nuclear war, religion, and family problems such as divorce. Many teachers are frightened of controversy because they have not experienced it themselves in an academic setting and don't know how to handle it. Most social studies teachers in U.S. schools are ill-prepared by their own schooling to deal with uncertainty, according to Shirley Engel. They are in over their heads the minute that pat answers no longer suffice. Inertia is also built into the system. Many teachers teach as they were taught. Even many college history professors, who well know that history is full of controversy and dispute, become old-fashioned transmitters of knowledge in their own classrooms. Since textbooks employ a rhetoric of certainty, it's hard for teachers to introduce either controversy or uncertainty into the classroom without deviating from the usual standards of discourse. Teachers rarely say, I don't know in class, and rarely discuss how one might then find the answer. I don't know violates a norm. The teacher, like the textbook, is supposed